Thomas, you talked about the rate of change, that it's going to be much faster both in climate and the adoption or the transition away from fossil fuels to electric cars, that sort of thing. Why do you say that, and how's it going to happen?
Rate of change is going to be high because if we look at climate change, the radiative forcing of the atmosphere is very high. So we're now adding about 2 to 3 parts per million of carbon dioxide to the atmosphere every year as a species. So we have already increased the amount since pre-industrial times. We've already increased the amount of carbon dioxide in the atmosphere by about 40%. There's an interesting sidebar to this that most folks don't realize, that about 40% of the carbon in their own bodies now comes from fossil fuels, because it goes through from the atmosphere into plants. We eat the plants, or we eat the animals that eat the plants, and that carbon ends up in our bodies. So that carbon has already permeated the entire biosphere. But the change now, the rate at which the carbon dioxide and other greenhouse gases are accumulating in the atmosphere is extremely high. This last year, 2016, saw the largest jump in carbon dioxide concentrations in recorded history. So that means that we are increasing global warming very fast. And everything else follows in the wake of that. The extreme weather events, droughts and storms and forest fires, and population displacements, potential effects on our food output. And it's those impacts that will drive our policy responses. Increasingly, people around the world and leaders will say, we have to do something. And this is happening as fast or faster than even most experts expected as recently as a few years ago.
You mentioned the adoption of electric cars. What is going to make that happen on a rapid basis?
Electrical vehicle technology is advancing really quite quickly, thanks in part to people like Elon Musk. Key factors are range and cost of the vehicles. What we're seeing is that the range is steadily increasing and the cost is steadily decreasing. And I showed a slide today in my presentation that indicated that for an electrical vehicle with a range of 200 miles, we are now pretty close to the average cost of a vehicle in the American vehicle fleet. And over a period of probably not more than about 20 years, those vehicles will become cheaper than the cheapest vehicle in the American vehicle fleet. Now, once people see that they can get one of these things, they hardly have to pay anything to run it. It doesn't require very much maintenance at all. You can run your house potentially from it by using the battery as a standby power system for your house. And they're actually really fun to drive. Then they're going to be starting to buy electrical vehicles. If you add on top of that various government incentives, which I think are necessary to really drive the process, because governments are going to be under pressure to do something about carbon emissions, then I think that this transition could happen very fast. My expectation would be that we will see pretty close to 100% of the vehicle fleet electric by 2035 to 2040.
This is the same sort of thing that's happened with solar, in that the price has really come down. So what is the role of solar at this time? Where does it fit in?
So solar is an interesting analog and complement to this story about electrical vehicles. First of all, on the innovation side, solar has seen a dramatic collapse in prices over the last 15 years or so in terms of the cost per watt of photovoltaic solar. That wasn't expected, but it happened through a whole series of incremental improvements in manufacturing that ramped costs down. I think we would expect the same thing with electrical vehicles. People forget that electrical vehicles are actually very simple. You have a battery and an engine and some gears to drive the drivetrain. The internal combustion engine is enormously complicated. So that simplicity allows for significant economies of scale and advances in cost. So these vehicles are going to have a cost advantage over internal combustion vehicles pretty soon. Now, in terms of providing power, solar will be one of the things that is part of the electrical generating capacity for our societies in the future. I was pretty clear today that what I call proximate solar, which is electrical power that is generated more or less directly from the sun, so that would include PV, solar panels, wind, perhaps biomass, where the solar energy falls on the surface of the planet and is fairly quickly converted into electrical energy. Those technologies, for a variety of reasons, don't have the power density that allows us to run our whole societies. We're going to need something else for electricity generation. I have some ideas of where we should go. One is ultra-deep geothermal, but solar will be part of the mix. There's no question about it. And we aren't going to be able to have enough solar power, though, to drive our entire vehicle fleet. I don't think that's the case. We need other sources of electrical energy.
Now, you've suggested that carbon sequestration and the use of enhanced geothermal, that we really should be giving these a serious look. Why?
Well, most folks who are serious about on the technical side and understand the technical challenges that we face with climate change and the kind of energy transition we have to undertake say that it's pretty well impossible to do without carbon capture and storage. There will be a period of time when we're still using substantial fossil fuel resources and we have to put that carbon underground, or we're going to be using fossil fuel resources to generate, say, a feedstock of hydrogen as an energy source, and then we have to take the carbon and put it somewhere. So one of the technologies I suggested today was deep underground coal gasification. In that case, you create a synthetic gas, a syngas underground, deep underground, bring it up to the surface, strip out the carbon dioxide and use the hydrogen, and then pump the carbon dioxide back underground. It could be an enormous source of carbon-free energy, but you have to do something with the carbon. So just about everybody in the business says we can't get to where we need to go without CCS, as they say it, carbon capture and storage. The problem is that it's very expensive. It has an energetic cost. It has a capital cost. And private companies have not been willing to bear the burden of pushing through the development process. And so this is a place where, unfortunately, government is absolutely essential in driving us down the cost curve. But it has to be done. Every serious analysis has a CCS component to it.
Well, what role does Alberta have to play in that? We have lots of coal underground, and it's supposed to be good quality. But we also have people who have spent the last several decades learning how to drill into the ground in order to take oil out.
Well, I think Alberta's expertise in drilling is actually a huge asset. In fact, its geotechnical and heavy engineering expertise, as I said today, are enormous assets in this new world, because wherever we're going in a zero carbon economy, we're still going to be extracting energy resources from underground. It could be in the form of heat in deep geothermal, where you have to go down 10 kilometers or more. It could be in the form of deep coal seams that you gasify underground, leave the carbon dioxide there. These are technologies that are viable and potentially scalable around the world. So Alberta has an enormous capacity to move in these areas if the province recognizes the urgency of the situation. And I think that this conference is a good recognition that people are starting to recognize the urgency, and I could tell afterwards that all these people were coming up to me with all of these ideas about what they're doing, which is very exciting and it's great. I mean, people are very serious and they're figuring things out. So it's a question of figuring out what the value-added or comparative advantage of Alberta is. What can the province bring to the table? Well, it's got some of the best drillers in the world. And if ultra-deep geothermal is a part of our energy mix in a major way in the future for humankind, then Alberta can be at the forefront of that.
Who's doing it now?
There's a firm in the UK called Strata Energy I talked about today that has mastered a percussion drilling mechanism where they can get through granite, which is incredibly hard rock, at 20 meters an hour, which is an extraordinary rate of progress. I'm really distressed that this technology has been developed outside of Canada. I'm sure the Chinese are working on it too. There's no reason why we shouldn't be at the leading edge of this.
Given that we're facing this climate change challenge, what is your message for Alberta innovators?
I think this is an opportunity, an enormous opportunity for the province. This is an energy province, and it's been at the leading edge, the frontier, with some extraordinary technologies for extraction of heavy oil, for example. There's no reason why it can't be at the leading edge in the future. So instead of seeing it as a threat, it needs to be seen as an opportunity, and understand the importance of harnessing the province's entrepreneurship to seize that opportunity.
Thank you very much, Thomas.
Good, thank you.